War Room, Impeachment with Stephen K. Bannon, Jason Miller, and Raheem Kassam. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome to our special New Year's Eve. It's Tuesday, 31 December, year of our Lord 2019. We not only end a year today, we end a decade. It is 10 years after the War Room Impeachment special. We're on Capitol Hill, just yards from the Capitol, where President Trump a couple of weeks ago was impeached as the 45th president of the United States. And it's where the trial of the century is going to start sometime in the next decade. We don't know which. This is episode 94. We're going to have this full discussion. We've got Raheem Kassam, the one of the architects of the most one of the most important events in this decade, the Brexit movement. And Raheem is going to walk us through the 10 years, and that's what we're doing, this 10 years of this kind of the populist nationalist revolt that is now engulfing the globe. And then we'll start the Roaring 20s. Tomorrow's show, New Year's Day, is going to be on the Roaring 20s, what to look forward to in the years ahead. We're on the John Frederick Radio Network, Salem Broadcast Radio Network, America's Voice.news, and of course, Newsmax TV, now crossing 70 million homes under the leadership of Chris Ruddy. Peter Navarro, the assistant to the president, is we're honored to be joined today. I want to go first to Peter. You're the economist. What the entire decade was started with a fuse that was lit before the decade in the 07, but really 08 time frame, and then 09 that led to the rise of Obama. And this was this financial crisis and the rise of China. So 10 years ago, where were you? The whole populist economic nationalist global revolt that we're seeing, whether it's on the left or on the right, was caused by this. Where were you 10 years ago, and what was your forecast? How did you think about this economic implosion?
So 10 years ago, we were in the depths of the financial crisis. 2 years before that, in my investor newsletter, the Well Time Strategy.
Newsletter. You're Peter Navarro, the raving man. What do you mean, investor? When I see the profiles of you, why do I never see investor newsletter?
It's the haters gotta hate. But I did that for years based on my work on macro forecasting and the business cycle.
Actually got paid for this?
Oh, of course I got paid for this. I was like a
so you were a professional
contributor on CNBC for many, many years, forecasting my way. One of the great book titles of all time, If It Rains in Brazil by Starbucks. Everybody always laughs. They don't know quite what it means, but it sounds kind of cool. But 2009, we're in the depths.
Does that have something to do with coffee?
So here's the deal. If it rains in Brazil, the price of coffee beans goes down, right? Cheaper for Starbucks to buy them.
Okay.
Their margins go down, their profits go up, so buy the Starbucks stock.
Got it.
Okay?
So you know
that's
what
all
doing.
I did was macro waves.
Got it.
Right? So I'm in 2009, 2 years before I predicted the crash in November of 2007, and I would spend the next 10 years basically railing on the old Biden administration for mistaking a structural problem with China draining 70,000 factories and 5 million manufacturing jobs out of the country going back to 2002, basically just depleting this country, trying to get people's attention and saying, look, the answer is not more Keynesian stimulus. They ignored me, and Obama doubled the debt from $10 trillion to $20 trillion in 8 years. We got stagnant growth, stagnant wage growth. The new normal became 2%. We lost 200,000 manufacturing jobs. I went on to write a book called Death by China and a movie, which I debuted just before the 2012 election for president, because I was desperately trying to get people's attention it's a structural problem, stupid. And out of that, finally, we had someone in Donald J. Trump who brought sanity to our economic policy, it was a structural problem.
I don't want to get ahead of the story. You predicted, and we're going to put up on the site, you actually in 07.
Yes.
Said before the year before
2007,
before the collapse of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers,
indeed,
right?
Indeed, and predicted the housing bubble collapse about the mid of 2006. I mean, you could see it all coming. And what China was doing, basically, by manipulating their currency, right? They'd come in and buy our treasury bills, and that would drive down interest rates, and that would allow everybody around America to become serial refinancers. And they were losing their jobs, yep. but in order to maintain their lifestyle,
yep.
they were taking equity out of their
equity
homes.
Loans.
I mean, it's like, I'm jumping up and down saying, what the heck's going on here? Why isn't anybody paying attention to
you
this?
Never get any credit for this.
I never get any credit for this.
So, Raheem, let
me just read this.
Go ahead.
For years,
you're pitching your newsletter. Leaves the White House, he's going to have another newsletter.
This is November 2007. For years, I warned about the Fed's easy money policies coupled with Chinese currency manipulation, working in league with sleazebag real estate appraisers who would set the price of a house at any level needed for somebody to qualify for a mortgage, no matter if they had income or not, and then throw in all the lenders who suckered all these people into exploding arms. Those were the adjustable rate mortgages. Well, you render the immortal worlds of W.C. Fields, you can't cheat an honest man. And presto, you've got a housing bubble sucking the life and capital of the American manufacturing economy. Yeah. Okay? November 2007. Okay? This populist revolution goes back all the way to China entry and Donald J. Trump in the 90s saying, hey, this will not stand.
This is why this is very deep. The politics of it you see roiling through, but it's very deep in this kind of economic issues. I want to go to Raheem, because here's what's so special about the show, and I was so excited about kind of structuring and doing it, is that looking back over the decade, this populist decade, I have the two guys. I have, President Trump finally decided to go from business into politics. You've been working, and you're one of the key architects of the Trump economic populism, economic nationalism, and Raheem is with... Really, and you were a voice in the wilderness, right?
Dismissed as a crank.
never mentioned his Harvard PhD. And Raheem, at the same time, it was Nigel Farage and Raheem that were for years talking about Brexit and how you had to get control of your country back, how immigration, which is a key part of the economics of it, and you tapped into something in working class people later in the decade that exploded. But go back 10 years ago, we know Navarro is selling out to the man and being a macro advisor, right? A macro advisory force.
I was populist for the small retail investor, Bannon. Did Goldman
some of your
Sachs
colleagues
darken
your,
my friggin' door.
Some of your colleagues are saying go long Lehman, just saying, but I didn't. Okay. So where were you 10 years ago, Raheem?
Lehman.
not even
a massive joke. My first job out of university, which was about 11-12 years ago, was with a mortgage company in the United Kingdom in London that was owned by Lehman Brothers.
Hold it. This is the tell when you got a when you're short. When the guys like Raheem are getting the mortgage, as you were dialing and smiling, selling mortgages.
I was collecting on debts. I was the guy who would call you up and say, hey, you know, you're behind 6 months.
Tell me about the experience.
You worked for George Soros before that.
How did that affect you?
Shorting the pound.
It was really soul destroying. I mean, calling people up who obviously had no idea what, you know, they had signed up to, LIBOR rates going through the roof, all of that, and they had no idea what was going on. And to call them up and you would say things to them like, hey, do you smoke cigarettes? And they'd say, well, yeah, I smoke cigarettes. What's it to you? And your job is to say, well, you're not buying that pack of cigarettes this week because you're paying us that extra £10 that you owe us to repay your interest. These guys were nowhere near the capital repayments. These were interest-only payments, and it was soul-destroying. I lasted in that job about 4 months before I said, you know what? I'm out of this. I can't stand it. I was obviously interested in politics, and we were seeing what Gordon Brown had been doing to the country. A lot of people have forgotten Gordon Brown now, but this is a guy that sold the UK's gold reserves at rock bottom prices.
We're going to have to jump to a break here in a moment. The question I've got is, do working class people, they were overwhelmed by this and the fact that they kind of understood, I think, something was going wrong, but it's these big forces that can, because you had
it's
this.
It's an undertow. They got sucked under by these macro forces and political leaders who simply did not or did not want to understand the structural rot caused by NAFTA and China sucking the lifeblood out of our manufacturing economy.
Did you see the same thing?
While it propped up the housing bubble.
We've got about 30 seconds. I got to jump to the thing. Did you see the same thing where people just didn't understand what the forces were that were sucking them out to sea?
And it wasn't just that. What occurred to me is these people were being exploited in a massive, massive way. And that's what you could hear on the phone every day. People would cry on the phone saying, I don't know. I don't understand. Why do I suddenly owe you $1,600? I thought I had a long-term low-interest deal with you guys, and it flipped, and they had no idea what hit.
Amazing background.
Exploding arms.
What?
Exploding arms. Adjustable-rate mortgages.
Exploding
they
arms.
Exploded.
Okay, we're going to take a short commercial break. We're going to return with War Room Impeachment. It's our New Year's Eve 10 Years After special. Stephen K. Bannon, Raheem Ghassan, Peter Navarro. We'll return in just a moment.
Bannon, Miller, Ghassan. War Room Impeachment on the John Fredericks Radio Network.
Episode 94 of War Room Impeachment. It is New Year's Eve, the 31st of December, the year of our Lord 2019. This will be our last show of the year, the last show of the decade. We're doing a special 10 years after. And the reason today we're doing 10 years after to look back on the financial collapse, the rise of China, and its impact to drive this kind of populist economic nationalist agenda in the United States, in the UK, and throughout the world. To set the stage for tomorrow, we're going to talk about the Roaring Twenties, what lays ahead of us. And the reason is this is the framework, this is the contextualization of the trial of the century that will kick off the new year. In fact, two very important things happened in the first 10 days of the new year, first couple of weeks. A monumental election in Taiwan for the Taiwan people to go against the Chinese Communist Party in the beginning of the trial of the century, the impeachment of the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. We are here every day on War Room Impeachment from Capitol Hill, just yards from the Capitol, to every day until the day after the exoneration of Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States. And there's going to be a lot of drama, a lot to talk about between now and then. John Fredericks Radio Network. Salem Broadcasting Nationwide, America's Voice throughout the world on the streaming platform, and of course, Newsmax TV. Raheem Ghassan from UKIP and Brexit. Peter Navarro, the populist, nationalist, economic architect, President Trump's of what is Trumpism. I want to go to Raheem for a second and back to Peter. So 10 years ago, when did you actually start to meet this guy, Farage? When did Farage come on the horizon for you?
So he was around then, but he was never a big part of our scene. The scene that was going on in the United Kingdom at the time was this rejection of the long-standing Tony Blair, Gordon Brown.
The neoliberalism.
Open the borders, sell off the gold, manage decline, but in a really fast way. And Farage was sort of around there. You'd see him popping up on like Zero Hedge and YouTube videos and from the European Parliament.
I watched him in YouTube videos in the European Parliament. I said, who is this guy? He would stand up and light up the guys in Brussels.
Yeah. And there was a lot of people
but
back
it was like
then.
It was a novelty act.
And they were more Tea Party than you know, MAGA or Brexit or America First back then. There was a lot more of just tax cuts, not as much focus
because
on trade, manufacturing.
So the parallel thing was the Tea Party, the great Tea Party revolt of 2010, the 62 seats. But the Tea Party, just like in the United Kingdom, was a more revolt against kind of the established order. Populism and economic nationalism hadn't gotten in there. Why was that? Why the Tea Party?
They rode a wave of rage in this country, but they missed the boat. They were the traditional Republican Party taken to an extreme. The libertarians loved the tax cuts, loved the deregulation, just didn't get it on trade, didn't understand the underlying rot in the U.S. manufacturing economy brought about by just rampant globalism. So that didn't last, and that's why the Republicans didn't seize power in 2012 in the White House.
But you see, and by the way, the populism that tried to get its roots in the 2012 primary of Rick Santorum, who tried but didn't go all the way, and even Newt Gingrich. Remember, they had that famous 30-minute film called The King of Bane, which went after Mitt Romney for basically shipping manufacturing jobs from, I think, a plant in South Carolina to Mexico. That went up, and you know, Rush Limbaugh the next day, you know, went nuts about, is this an attack on capitalism? Newt Gingrich tried to put his toe in the water a little bit to try to get some populism, but everybody backed off, right? Everybody backed off in that primary. Even Rick Santorum, who later got religion on blue collar
Romney ran a 100-yard dash on the China issue, and he just spectacularly tripped up at about 90 yards, fell flat on his face with the famous or infamous 47% comment that was leaked out. And I remember I was in Ohio at the time, touring with my film Death by China as a way to try to raise awareness.
Very subtle title.
In 2012, in terms of the China issue. And there was a bright, shining moment there for a couple of weeks where Obama and Romney actually went toe-to-toe on the China issue, and it looked like that was going to elevate. That could have won him an election, but once that 47% came out, he just died on the vine.
The structural issues and the things about the structural part in the financial collapse, that's why I always say that the U.K. is always about 6 months to a year, I think, politically ahead of where we are. And I want to go back to this midsection around the Tea Party revolt, but it's not really – it's populist in that there's working class people, but the economics of it haven't really set in. Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. England, the U.K., and I think this is the roots of what Boris Johnson versus real populism and real economic nationalism is going to be, his – what I call Boris Johnson's Singapore on the Thames idea. The Britain had gone and really thrown away their manufacturing base. Much of this was going to Germany and then to China. Cool Britannia. Yeah. Remember, Tony Blair and these guys had really become the ether of what neoliberalism is, right? Even worse than in the United States, it was Tony Blair and Gordon Brown that had gone into and completely forgotten.
Yeah.
Completely forgotten working class people. As the Labour Party, they weren't talking about working class issues. How did you pick up on that?
Well, remember, there was a part of Labour's long-standing, decades-long manifesto, the core of what they stood for, which was basically, we believe that whenever something is big enough, we should nationalise it. Right, that was part and parcel of what it meant to be part of the Labour Party. And Tony Blair got rid of that, which, you know, for people like us, cool, that's fine, that's great. Right. But the what the Labour working classes heard, what their core voters heard, were, okay, so you're not going to look after these mining jobs anymore. You don't care about anything that Thatcher did that they didn't like back then. Blair, of course, in his autobiography a couple of years after he left office, wrote that he governed as a conservative, not a small C conservative, but like he was a member of the Tory party, the neoliberal ruling elite. And he offered that within the first three pages of his autobiography. So on the one hand, you had him assaulting the right, and one of his former speechwriters actually said the reason we threw open the borders was to rub the right's nose in diversity. That's a quote. So you had the assault on the traditional right, and then you had an assault on the labor working classes. And that's why you see Jeremy Corbyn not being able to muster up anything more than 160-odd seats, which is a humiliation now. He sets himself up as if he's this radical anti-Blair type.
Let me ask
he's
you very a quick similar. Question. How did London become the center of Chinese capital?
The city of London.
City of London. I mean, everybody, to me, Britain fails on the China issue because of that. How did that happen?
In the very same way that we've become a little Riyadh and a little Moscow as well. You know, these foreign powers actually own more real estate and more wealth in London, in Britain's capital, than our monarchy does, which is a thing that flipped a couple of years ago.
I think you remember the way they're structured. I say it's the British East India Company mentality in reverse. Yeah. Remember, the way the UK's empire was, the Navy was very powerful but relatively small. The Army was very small, and they had how they did it was really they corporatized the empire. Mm-hmm. In the reverse of that, you saw that's why they were very open to Chinese capital. That's why they were very open to from the Gulf Emirates. Okay, we're going to take a break. We're 10 years after the financial crisis and the rise of populism, economic nationalism over the decade of the 2010s. We're ending that decade tonight at midnight. This is War Room Impeachment, Stephen K. Bannon, episode 94. We'll take a short commercial break. Remember, go to warroom.org all day. You're going to get this. We're going to return in a minute. Peter Navarro, Raheem Kassam, Stephen K. Bannon. Be back in a moment.
Bannon, Miller, Kassam. War Room Impeachment. On the John Fredericks Radio Network.
Welcome back. Episode 94. It's New Year's Eve, 31 December. Tuesday, 31 December, year of our Lord, 2019. 10 years after, we're going through the decade that led or drove the rise of populism and economic nationalism, not just in the United States and Great Britain, but throughout the world. But leaders like Nigel Farage and Donald Trump, and I have two of their wingmen, honored to have them in the studio today. Perfect time to do this show, and perfect two guys to have it. Raheem Kassam, who was one of the architects of Brexit, and Peter Navarro is one of the architects of Trumpism, President Trump's economic nationalist policies. The reason we're doing this in War Room Impeachment is that impeachment and Brexit are the nullification project by the elites, by the established order, of the challenge to managed decline. And managed decline is more than just messaging. We'll talk about the messaging, but it got deeply embedded into the elites. Let's start in the UK first. How did the reaction start, and how deeply was this thing that Britain went from Cool Britannia, just that it was just going to be part of the EU and take orders from Brussels?
Well, Cool Britannia was a form of managed decline. This was the campaign slogan that Blair ran on in 97. He got his massive majority as a result of it. Cool Britannia was effectively saying, hey, don't worry about power. Don't worry about influence. Don't worry about our world role. We feel cool in and of ourselves. We got the Spice Girls. We got David Beckham's right foot. We got David Beckham's left foot. And that was all it came down to, was our little cultural things that the world sort of thought were quirky and fun. Don't worry about anything real serious. Then, in after Lehman Brothers collapses in 2008, and we have our own financial shocks, and the Royal Bank of Scotland, Fred Goodwin, otherwise known as Fred the Shred, loses the knighthood over it. Then we have this ushering in of David Cameron. He's the great hope of the Conservative Party, but
who happens to be a PR guy.
A PR guy, had been in Parliament just a couple of years. He wasn't very well
now experienced.
Now on
the payroll of the CCP.
And by the way, used to once upon a time invoke the memory of Enoch Powell on that parliamentary chamber floor, and then turned full globalist. 2010, 2011, he doesn't win an outright majority. He goes into coalition government with the Liberal Democrat Party, and it becomes a total and complete mess. They can't figure out where the country should go policy-wise.
So Britain goes in a completely globalist.
Yeah, he was on Mitt Romney.
In the United States at the same time, you have Mitt Romney, but also a consensus now of the elites in the established order that globalism is it, right? That defending economic nationalism. And it's not even a conversation, really, about China.
Yeah, let me tell you what the elites were telling the people of America. Your wages were going to be stagnant. We couldn't grow above 2% because it was the new normal. We were in a post-manufacturing world. Those jobs were gone
economy.
Forever. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it
My
is.
My buddy Gary and now, Cohen's service economy.
Yeah, now, here's the thing, Steve. Once you accept that reality,
yes,
all politics is about redistributing income from the wealthy to everybody else. That's all it becomes. And these folks did not understand that this was a structural problem that you could solve with the 4 points of the Trump economic policy compass: deregulation, tax cuts, cheap energy, and most of all, fair and reciprocal trade. And that was, it was like the Wall Street elites, the corporate elites, were selling that to the people. The politicians were taking their contributions and buying that message because they couldn't figure out how else to get elected. You'd have the Tea Party types come in and try to harness some of the rage, but they didn't have the right message.
The energy and the
and
anger.
And so we had 15 years after China joined the WTO, the World Trade Organization, wandering through the wilderness. And it took Donald J. Trump to crystallize the message and correctly identify
the problem. When did this start for you guys in the United Kingdom? We're going to take a short commercial break and come back in a second, but I want to tee it up. When did it become that Farage went from a novelty act that I used to see on YouTube videos in some place called Brussels, the European Parliament, I don't know what it was, to more into the decade when Farage, and you focus on Brexit, though, here's what we have to, step one, we've got to take our country back from the centralized government that's running everything in the United Kingdom. That's step one of our populism and economic nationalism. We got to get control. If we don't have that, when did that start to crystallize?
Similarly to what Peter said, it was about the people realizing that they were constantly being told, you're not going to get above this certain growth level. And then what the really interesting part was when David Cameron pursued gay marriage in the United Kingdom. And it was a kind of a left field thing nobody expected. And lots of conservative voters suddenly went, well, we weren't okay with any of this stuff in the first place, But now we're seeing something that we're really uncomfortable with.
On the cultural side.
On the cultural side. And that's when Farage started to pick up all these votes from the Conservative Party. And that's when
UKIP. The rise of UKIP.
In 2013, local elections. In 2014, the European elections.
That's when I found that's it. When it that's started when I started teeing up you guys. Okay, we're going to take a short commercial break. We're going to turn to War Room Impeachment. It's the end of the decade, 10 years after. We're going to take a short commercial break. We're going to return with Peter Navarro, Raheem Kassam, Stephen K. Bannon in just a moment.
Bannon, Miller, Kassam. War Room Impeachment on the John Fredericks Radio Network.
It's Tuesday, the 31st of December, year of our Lord, 2019, episode 94, War Room Impeachment, 10 years after our show that closes the decade, one of the most volatile decades in political history, and teeing up what is the Roaring Twenties. That will be tomorrow's New Year's Day show. We're here 7 days a week. Raheem Kassam, Peter Navarro. Okay, put us into the fight, Raheem, in a couple of minutes. We're pressed for time here, but you were the wingman for Nigel Farage. You had this enormous thing, Brexit. This concept that had been literally at the beginning of the decade, Tony Blair with Gordon Brown, the idea that the United Kingdom would leave the EU is so outrageous, yeah. Right? It's so big in its
they
scale.
They laughed at us.
And it was inextricably linked to the Trump revolt and gave sustenance to the Trump revolt.
Yeah, they laughed. I mean, remember, Nigel Farage didn't invent the idea of leaving the European Union, but he did popularize it. And he popularized it, as I was saying, after we saw the Tories and the Liberal Democrats go into coalition government together, people were seeing the worst of both worlds. They were seeing the worst of redistributive socialism and the worst of crony capitalism under a conservative banner and mantra. And so we saw that votes from the left and votes from the right were up for grabs. And that, although Nigel had been doing this for decades, that was when we finally started hitting upon this populism thing, going around the country, doing these rallies that you saw ahead and during the European parliamentary elections.
I traipsed along with you guys, just watch it. And this is amazing.
And say, and by the way, and to the heartlands, to the real Britain, not to Knightsbridge, not to Islington, but to places like Castle Point, and to places like Sunderland, and to places like in Wales, and saying to these people, look, you were stripped of your economic dignity, you've been stripped of your cultural dignity, and now they're coming after you and saying, you will never get any of this back, we're part of the EU, and we're never leaving. We just stood up there and said something very simple. No.
When a young Raheem Kassam pitched me on this idea in the fall of 2013.
Yeah.
I think we'd made contact like in 2013 earlier, yeah. Finally met up. 2013 pitched his exact thing and said, we're going to launch Breitbart London as a platform and this country is going to leave the EU. And I go, God bless you. I'm in. I said, let's do it. But at the same time, this was at the forefront of it. But at the same time, your books are coming out of China. You're still looked at as a pariah, but all of a sudden they begin the primary in 2015. Trump's talking about this CPAC in 13 and 14, but 15 campaign starts and it's electric.
The day he declared, I wrote an article that said he was going to win the primary, right? And over 12 debates and 9 forums, he crushed traditional republicanism one nickname at a time. Jeb goes down, Marco, Ted, all of them. And the resonance of that message in those debates was overwhelming. And people, the only people who didn't get it was the mainstream media and Hillary
Clinton.
The gift that kept on giving during that campaign was deplorables. Mm-hmm. When she basically gave us that label for the hardworking men and women of America who work with their hands, And the prime age workers, remember Steve, 1 out of 4 prime age workers between these ages like 25 and 51 or something were sitting home on the couch in the long term, unemployed, not being counted in the worker, just depressed because they had no hope and no prospects. And we're going off of the Obama years where we lost 200,000 manufacturing jobs, wages were stagnant. Steve, right now we've hit $63,000 median household income, highest on record. Over 2 million of the deplorables, prime age workers, back into the workforce. So this was a revolution that the Tea Party tried to harness but didn't understand how to do it. Donald J. Trump did with that walk down the escalator. and to walk on the stage during the debates, and he crushed it.
There wasn't much. I want to go to two things. There wasn't much intellectual pushback. When you really look at, there was a lot of name calling, yeah. And obviously everybody's a racist, everybody's a xenophobe, everybody's a nativist. They got to get to all that, right? Because that's the playbook, that's the parlor trick. But when you really go back and look at it, and that's why this Washington Post article on populism is so important, is that you don't see a serious pushback intellectually. Two things I want to start with, Raheem. The pushback, but here's what I don't get. One of the reasons that elites kind of continue on is they're adaptive. Why was there not more pushback intellectually, besides the BBC name-calling nonstop? And why did the elites so make this the hill to die on, of which they kind of have died? It's been shattered. Something different is going to come out of the UK. Why was there not something that was more formal than Navarma coming to you with the same question?
I remember a friend telling me in 2013, she said the reason we ended up with people like Blair and Cameron in the first place is we lost all of our good stock during the two wars. You know, and there's some truth to that. A lot of the British intelligentsia, the ingenuity was wiped out. The people who were on those front lines were actually a lot of the people who were country, nation leaders and thought leaders. So there's that. The other thing is they never expected it to go this far. The mantra that they kept repeating to themselves, they thought, this at some point this will cut through. At some point, remember, before the Brexit vote, World War III, economic recession, depression, all of this stuff. We're going to look like minnows, little Englanders on the world stage. They thought that would cut through. They didn't understand that people, we would knock on people's doors on the run-up to the Brexit vote, and they would talk to us. They would raise with us the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership.
I know. It's you, Tip. We got about a minute.
It's the same thing. Nobody believed Donald J. Trump was going to be president. I mean, you had all of the elites, you know, Paul Krugman. I mean, even after he got elected, he said we were going to go into the Depression. You had Hillary, didn't even bother to go to the blue wall states to campaign because she thought she was going to cruise to a victory. Mm-hmm. Nobody thought that this man would become president yet. Down in the heartland, everybody knew he would.
We're going to tee it up. We got about 30 seconds left. On the morning, we won at 2:30 in the morning on the 9th. At 7 o'clock, you were on CNBC going...
Dow 25,000.
Go long, baby. Go long, Trump. Okay, we're going
to take... 4 points of the compass.
We're going to take a quick commercial break and turn with Raheem and Peter Navarre, and we're going to talk about Tee Up Tomorrow's Roaring Twenties. We're going to give Peter Navarre's thoughts, economic thoughts, of where we're going next. On War Room Impeachment.
Bannon, Miller, Kassam. War Room Impeachment.
On the John Fredericks Radio Network.
Tuesday, 31 December, year of our Lord, 2019. Yes, it's the end of a decade. We're on Capitol Hill in the War Room. Episode 94, Raheem Kassam, Peter Navarro. 10 years after, looking back at this decade that will never be forgotten about the rise of populism and economic nationalism. Okay, Raheem, tomorrow's show is going to be the Roaring Twenties. We start off with two things. The trial of the century of Donald J. Trump will be on trial in the United States Senate as 45th president impeached. Also, we've been promised on the 31st of January, from June 26th, I think it was, of 2016 to 31 December, is the established order going to allow a Brexit to actually happen on midnight 31 December of 2020?
I have said no to that question every time I've been asked the last 3 years. I'm going to say yes to it this time. And the reason I'm going to say yes to it is we had the ultimate expression of the will to continue Brexit in a general election just a couple of weeks ago. You've now had, I think,
Referendum, really.
I think you've had now six or seven of these, if you include the 15 election, the 16 referendum, and all the elections and local elections and national elections, European elections that are taking place since. Yes, I think Britain will leave the European Union on the 31st of January.
Navarro called the 2008 financial collapse in 2007. He called the rise of Donald Trump early in 2014 and 15. He called on the morning of November 9th. He actually called Dow 30,000. Aaron Sorkin got to say, no, our show's going to get pulled off here. And Stephen K. Bannon immediately, you know, shut him down.
Hold me up.
You got two minutes. Tell us where this
Jared
is.
Jared Cohn be our forecaster.
Yeah, exactly. Mnuchin and Cohn. Yeah. Tell us where we're going in 2020.
You can read about it with Chris Ruddy, the great patriot on Newsmax front page today. Love the guy. So here's the forecast. Closer to 3% real GDP growth than 2%. That's very, very robust. We're going to pass 30,000 on the Dow, and I'm looking at a target for 32,000 by Election Day. Now, why? 4 points to the policy compass remain in place. Tax cuts, deregulation, cheap energy, and fair trade are going to power this economy. But more importantly, the four drivers of the GDP equation are hitting on all cylinders because of President Donald J. Trump. Consumer is super strong because unemployment's low, wages are rising, and confidence is high. You've got investment coming in because of the tariffs. Everybody wants to be here. You've got trade deals, five of them in place: China, South Korea, Canada, Mexico, Japan. Farmers going to be happy. Manufacturers going to be happy. Exports are going to be happy. And then the last thing, the sleeper. The National Defense Authorization Act, plus the appropriations bill, huge, huge, huge fiscal stimulus for 2020. That's going to take us through this year. It's going to be a great year for America. High wages, low unemployment, happy, happy new year.
Okay, this is why they have to impeach him. They can't beat him economically. They can't beat him at the ballot box.
The Al Green problem, yes.
Al Green is a prof in that regard. Okay, this has been 10 years after. Join us tomorrow, 9 a.m. every day, 7 days a week here at Raheem Kassam, Stephen Gubaner. Here be for the Roaring 20s. We'll see you in War Room Impeachment in a new decade tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.